White Area and Resistance Radio calling. White Area and Resistance Radio calling. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, right here in the bunker in North Central Indiana at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. It is October the 27th, 2014, and we're almost out of October, so if you're going to get it done, you better do it pretty quick, because you only got two or three days left. And before Halloween, a lot of crazy things, spooky things supposed to happen on Halloween. Yeah, I got my plan. Gee, it's almost time to get your donations for the show in for November. Yeah, so anyhow, and if you don't have them in for October, I don't think there's hardly anybody that doesn't, but I'm going to check, man. Well, and when you hear that tick-tock, tick-tock, and you hear the wolves cry, man, you know where I'm coming from. You know where I'm coming from. It say here in the Wall Street Journal, New York City's top counter-terrorism official went to Florida last week to warn a group of police chiefs about the growing threat of self-radicalized terrorists. Self-radicalized terrorists. Back home in New York City on Thursday, a 32-year-old man provided Exhibit A, attacking two police officers with a hatchet before he was shot and killed by the copperoos. At first glance, the attack outside a Queens department store seemed simply the act of a deranged man acting alone. But to a growing number of local and national law enforcement officers, the attack represented terrorism inspired by extremist websites. Whoop! Extremist websites and social media. Whoa! I wonder if that includes us. That exhorts alienated people to take up the cause with acts of violence. I exhort alienated population to take up acts of violence in the form of a revolution in this country. We need a revolution. We're long overdue for a revolution, or you want to call it civil war. I guess I can't say I haven't talked like that. And I can't say I'll ever quit talking like that until they stick a sock in my mouth. Law enforcement officials say these lone wolves type of terrorists, which simply means individual people who believe in unconventional warfare, that's all it is, they're hard to defend against. Well, no shit, Sherlock. Seems like I've told you that a long time ago. Of course, the right wing hasn't got that message yet. They want to do everything with bunches of people. New York Police Commissioner William Bratton, the top cop, said Friday that even though police believe the man with the hatchet acted alone, they're treating it as a terrorist attack. There is a growing number of these individuals out there, unquote, he said. There always has been a growing number of individuals like that out there. It's called crime. You go up there to South Chicago and you'll see a lot of lone wolves. Maybe we should call them black lone wolves. We got the black KKK. Maybe that isn't quite strong enough. Black lone wolves. Yeah. Last week's attack in New York in Ottawa, Canada, where a lone gunman shot and killed a soldier at a national war memorial and then stormed Parliament before he stormed. One guy stormed Parliament. I love the way these people go crazy. Before he was gunned down. Underscore a rising concern of U.S. and Western counter-terrorist officials. One-off homegrown attacks. Wow, man. Let's see, where did I end up? I went from one page to the other. Something about and disrupt then the more complex terror plots that have been focused of law enforcement and intelligence agencies for more than a decade. While the threat of such attacks isn't new, they have become a bigger worry because of the more sophisticated social media propaganda of the extremist group Islamic State. Well, why'd you leave us out, man? Come on. The threat facing the U.S. now, as it facing the U.S., why not the people of the U.S. or the white people or the Mexican people, now has a different element to it. And those traditional counter-terrorism apparatuses are not well suited to spotting them. We need more NSA activity, said John Cohen. Cohen, isn't that Hebrew? Who recently left his post as the top counter-terrorism official at the Department of Homeland Security to teach at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Quote, what we saw in Canada and in New York is an illustration of how the extremist threat has evolved, he said. Well, it might have something to do with you declaring war or not declaring war, invading all countries all over the place, bombing the shit out of them, ruining their land with depleted uranium, kids being born with two heads and everything else. That might have something to do with people being pissed off. But you notice this U.S. exceptionalism and the Republican and Democrat exceptionalism?
It's all right for us to bomb the shit out of everybody, but they better not come mess with us.
Jesus Christ. Drives you crazy. They don't even use simple logic. Anything that's happened in this country by these people, even though a lot of the time it's ill-directed, but any type of situation like that, we ask for it. The military-industrial complex caused it. And if anybody comes back on us from some other country, well, anyhow, they're not out to get you anyhow. The chances of you being blown away by one of these people is 1,000 to 1, 10,000 to 1. And of course, if you found out where one was, like the guys that supposedly drove the plane into the buildings in New York, that only were living about 40 miles from me, and if I'd have known about it and went down there and blew them away, they'd call me the terrorist. I'd be in prison for 100 years. Yeah, that's right. Even though you curtailed an attack that killed thousands of people. New York City has one of the world's largest sophisticated anti-terrorist efforts. Of course you have to, because your city is full of bullshit races. You got a hodgepodge of everybody. Anybody can come to New York. And if they want to, they can get violent. And then you got your internal, like the black KKK, too, to deal with. And an apparatus built up after 9/11 attacks, working with counterparts around the world. Oh, yeah? You spent billions on Homeland Security, and what have you gotten? It's a racket, baby. It's a racket. But the New York State attacker, identified by police, was Zale Thompson. He wasn't on the radar. Police say that after the attack, they learned that Mr. Thompson was visiting extremist websites. Maybe White Aryan Resistance. We don't know for sure, but we're checking it out. Including those linked to terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and Al-Shabaab. Sounds like a sandwich. He has an extensive social media presence. Oh my God, he's using his computer to go around and check things out. We gotta stop that. John Miller, the NYPD deputy commissioner who oversees counterterrorism and intelligence, and who attended the Florida conference, and then they had a few whores serve them up that evening after the conference, of course. Lots of liquor, everything. The best rooms, taxpayers pay for it on these meetings by these assholes. The common threads that go through those conversations are anti-Western, anti-government, and in some cases, anti-white. Well, I don't think that they're anti-white because of what you and me have done, the working class. If they're anti-white, I think it largely due to you bomb their family and bomb their wedding parties, and then you send mostly white troops over there, a lot of white troops. So, you know, let's be fair about this. Mr. Miller said that Mr. Thompson's internet history indicates that he was looking at different acts of violence. There's thousands, millions of people going on to YouTube looking at violence, including beheading videos recently made public by ISIS. I still don't see the difference in beheading than putting a bullet to somebody's head. I mean, death is death. Hours before his own attack in Queens, police say he was reading about the attack a day earlier in Ottawa. Well, like I've got that book called The 1000th Monkey, and that's all that stuff. If you'll read Crowd Psychology by Gustave Le Bon, well, of course, people, it's a habit. Two or three guys do it, and then two or three more guys do it, and pretty soon everybody's doing it. Well, I'll get off of this silly article that was in a New York News, Wall Street Journal. Just designed to con people. You know, every day we hear and we talk, and even I've talked about they're out to destroy the white race. They're out to get the white race. No, they're not out to get the white race. They're out to get the part of the right white race they don't need, are in the way, are troublemakers. And of course, they're doing it to other races too, as far as that's concerned. But that's what they want. They want this ruling class of whites, which will be a smaller amount when they trim down, but be in total absolute control, and to use the non-whites, whatever that they can use, and if they don't go along, kill them. And so whenever somebody says, they're out to destroy the white race, no, these guys are not out to destroy the whole race. They're out to get rid of you. You can't make them any money anymore. You bailed the cat. You got to go. Only the top percentage will be around. So when anybody says they're going to wipe out the white race, tell them, wait a minute. They're not going to wipe themselves out. They're going to wipe out the ones that are in the way. You know, you hear every day about how the United States is spreading democracy around the world, and we're trying to install democracy around the world. Well, I hope we're all smart enough to know that's a bunch of bullshit. It's got nothing to do with democracy when you blow up countries, crush countries, steal all their goodies, and then try to tell me, well, we're going to get rid of a dictatorship and build democracy. No, they're building predatory capitalism. It's all predatory capitalism. Follow the money. They have no intention on rebuilding Iraq. Are you kidding? They keep crashing it down every couple of years. They have no will to rebuild Afghanistan or any of these countries. No, they just want to crush them and then rebuild them in the sense of predatory capitalism. That's what they want to do. That's all they're doing. And this capitalism is destroying everybody. Every country in the world, predatory capitalism is screwing with. Oh, there's one that they're not screwing with too much. Guess which one that is. Yeah, right. Jaime, I see here on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, incumbent Dilma Rousseff Center won a second term as president of Brazil Sunday, defeating the conservative Aécio Neves in an acrimonious race. Well, first of all, forget conservative, liberal, all that bullshit. The vote comes as Brazil copes with a stagnant economy and a large population clamoring for change. Well, they're going to get change, all right. No, they're not going to get any change. It'll still be the elite running the show. Yeah, they're so happy and thrilled. I cast my vote, senor. I'm looking for a better life. I want some water in my house. I want indoor plumbing. and maybe this one. Well, wait a minute. She didn't give it to us last session she won. Why would you expect she's going to give it to you this session? It's the same old bullshit. Well, the European banks get a healthy checkup, hoping to quell years of anxiety over Europe's financial health. No, they want to quell the fact that they've been robbing the investors and everybody else for a long time. Regulators said Sunday that all but three of the continent's leading banks have enough capital to ride out another economic storm. Well, where did all that capital go? Where did it go? If they had a lot of capital before, where did it go? Well, of course, it went to the capitalists. That's what they like. They like to get all that capital, the capitalists. The European Central Bank and the European Banking Authority announced the results of a nearly year-long effort to assess the finances of 150 banks, identifying 13 that still need to come up with a total of $12 billion in extra capital. Well, where'd the capital go? Who got the capital? Well, that's the way it works. Overall, 25 banks technically failed in so-called stress tests, facing a cumulative shortfall of $24.6 billion. But most have already taken steps to solve their problems. Oh, yeah? Okay, that's enough of that. I'm not going to insult your intelligence by reading farther. Now, for all you people out there that think the states still have some rights, of course, I hate that word because it's meaningless. It's privileges that the federal government allows you to have. And if you don't go along with it, remember what happened in the Civil War? The White House pushed back against governors of states that quarantined medical workers returning from West Africa, saying the policy could hurt the fight against Ebola. No, it's never. If you seal off your state, it can't make things worse. But the point is, this has nothing to do with Ebola. It has to do with American corporations, and the capitalistas don't want any restrictions in travel because they lose money. The airlines lose money. The corporate robbers that go over to Africa and steal everything, they lose money. No. Just like the Jews started with immigration. We want wide open borders, man, so we can transfer that wealth from everywhere. They don't give a shit about Ebola. Like I said before, there's far more people die of all kinds of things in this country. Heart disease, auto wrecks, everything, than will ever die from Ebola. And they say it's making things too hard on the black people of Africa. Well, I wouldn't mind if it got a lot harder for the black people of Africa. Even though a lot of that stuff has, if you look back at the operations of the corporations and so forth, had a lot to do with the conditions arising like these things, just like World War I led to the great flu influenza. Killed lots of people. I watched a film the other night. I never heard of it before. It's not an exciting film. It's about It's the title's 1918, and it's about a little town, I think, down in Texas that just had a regular, you know, middle-class white community. And when the war came, they got excited about that. And a lot of the guys went overseas, and some, a lot of them didn't come back. And then the flu started, killed half the town. And I think viruses and things like that are directly affected by massive killing and sanitation problems. Anyhow, it was sad because a lot of those people were beating the drum to go fight Germany. You know, like Germany is going to attack Texas. I see that the subject of this film, I didn't write it down here, Gary Webb, who I believe wrote a book about this Contra connection and the cocaine that I talked about on the show the other day. He was going to be on, he's on YouTube on a television interview show, and I just tried to download it. You only get about 3 minutes, and it cuts out. So I think they're sabotaging him. But anyhow, he was blown up by the CIA, undoubtedly. Killed. Murdered. Dead. Oh yes, that film with Mr. Webb was Kill the Messenger. Make it a point to see that film. Kill the Messenger. That's right. I'm not quite sure how big a blank there is in the show right there. I've got a little problem with this recording program in the number 8 system on the computer, and sometimes it causes the MP3 recorder to cut out, so I can't use that internal deal like that. If you're a white activist and you don't like race mixing, especially with the black race, then you got to listen to this. I don't want you to get too sick and vomit all over your desk or bed or wherever you're at. But I think you need to hear this to get it through your head that we're being betrayed internally. In this case, it's the white females of the country, at least a percentage.
Nation, and Suzanne knew she wanted to be a mother. But when she turned 40, she was still single. So she opted for artificial insemination and then in vitro fertilization. None of the procedures worked. So in her mid-40s, she decided to adopt. Suzanne, who was white, was open to adopting an African-American baby. It's called transracial adoption. Producers Dan Collison and Elizabeth Meister followed Suzanne through the adoption process, and this is her story. It's called Dear Birth Mother, and it was produced in association with Chicago Public Radio.
Dear Birth Mother, writing a letter to someone who could change my life so dramatically is scary, to say the least, but nowhere near as scary as the task I know you face in choosing a future for your child. I'll start by introducing myself. I'm Suzanne. I was blessed. I wrote this letter to an audience of women I haven't met, women who will use this letter to help them decide if I'm the best person to raise their child. It's one of the first steps in the adoption process, and it's kind of one part autobiography, one part marketing piece. Personality-wise, I'm very outgoing, warm, and affectionate with a sunny disposition. I'm extraordinarily perceptive and caring and have been known to cry at commercials. I was taught to be open and honest. I'm working with a domestic adoption agency, and they'll pass my letter along to these women who have chosen to place their baby with another family. As you may know, I'm single. Unfortunately, now that I feel like I could be the best wife and mother yet, it's harder than ever to meet Mr. Right. The upside to this, however, is that your child will be my number one priority. I want you to know that I will love and cherish him or her with all my heart.
All right, all right, all right, all right. We're we're going to get started.
The state of Illinois requires me to take parenting classes before I can adopt. Because I'm open to a child of any race, especially because the waiting period can be much shorter for babies of color, my agency suggested this series of seminars on transracial adoption led by biracial women.
My name is Michelle M. Hughes. I'm an adoption attorney. The workshops that we're doing right now, the primary purpose, I joke, it's basically training white people to raise kids of color.
The fact is, there are so many babies of color in this country that are not being adopted, agencies actually make the fees more affordable to try to find a home for these babies.
There's frankly a supply and demand issue. There's just not enough parents stepping up to the plate to adopt African American children. Consequently, it means that agencies discount these children in order to get them placed.
The room is filled with mostly white people. And when you first walk in, there's a little container of beads of different colors, and there are questions asking you, pick a bead that corresponds to the answer to each question. And the questions are, what color are most of the people in your neighborhood? What color are most people you work with?
The bead exercise is to get people in a place where they're willing to listen. Because I think a lot of people walk into the room thinking, a baby's a baby, and it doesn't make a difference.
I feel like I probably have more friends of color than most white people that I know, but when I look at my bag, it is very lily white.
This is a fairly alienating experience to sort of come into as the first thing that you're being introduced to in this workshop. It just felt like, is this something I shouldn't do? This is wrong, that my child's always going to feel lonely. And kind of put me a little bit on the defensive, to tell you the truth.
Tonight, what we have is four panelists for you, and all of our panelists, our parents, have already transracially adopted.
One mother told us about her biological daughter, who's white, and this daughter had a really good playmate down the street, but when the family adopted their first African-American baby, this friend just kind of disappeared. The mother's pretty sure that the parents of this little girl said she couldn't play with their daughter anymore because of their adopted black baby.
And we had to explain immediately that family's family, and this is no friend. It's a hard thing. It will hit you immediately.
And then they also told a story about taking their child to an African-American barber. And then at one point, the barber said, you are not the mother of this curly-headed boy.
I said, oh, yes, I am. That's my son. No, you are not a mother of a curly-headed black boy. And one of the things I have learned from being up there is that I will never disrespect anyone, never. But I hold my ground. I will not back down either. So I simply said, my son was born 12 weeks early. When he was addicted in the hospital, I'm the one that went every day. I held my son. I've adopted my son. I've taken care of him for 5 years. I am the mother of a curly-headed black boy. He said, okay, we're friends now.
That's a whole other aspect that I kind of hadn't really thought much about, is like, you know, prejudice from the black community as well. That what are you white lady, what are you doing with this baby, one of our babies? I know where their heart is, but I think it seems a little misdirected, because these kids would most likely go into the foster care system. But if you could be sensitive to the child's cultural heritage, then that's a pretty darn good compromise.
Okay. Do you open to a child whose birth mother used marijuana at some time during pregnancy?
Would consider. In every adoption, there are risks.
A child whose birth mother used cocaine at some time during pregnancy?
I'm going to say no to that one. One of the big risks is just not knowing whether your birth mother abused alcohol or drugs during her pregnancy. So I ask about this at my first meeting with my adoption agency.
What is the procedure to sort of find out about this birth mother and her drug use?
Self-report.
Pure self-report, nothing else.
We can't do anything else. We can't tax test.
Because it's illegal or it's...
It's intrusive, for one thing. And, yeah, we can't insist on any treatment or tax testing.
I talked to one couple who adopted a child, and they had the child tested, and were told that the child had some really severe problems with having cocaine in its system. That was through the same agency that I'm working with. And they had this heartbreaking decision to make. And here they had the child already living with them and really had bonded with the child. So they realized that this child was going to need a whole lot of
special attention, you know, just in terms of its basic development. And so they decided they weren't up for that. They just couldn't provide the time and energy that the baby needed, so they gave the baby back.
That's part of the risk. There is a risk that you take in this, going into adoption. That's one of them.
My name is Suzanne. I live on the north side of Chicago.
It's a few weeks later, and I'm at another transracial adoption workshop.
And I'm Anne. I live on the northwest side of the city of Chicago.
There are a couple other single mothers in the group, and one woman, Anne, announced that she had been placed with a baby. She'd had a referral for a baby, had met the birth mother, and the baby was due in May. And so that was received with, you know, warm applause and hoo-has.
And I had lunch with her today. So I'm very happy.
That was heartening to me because she was single and actually got a placement pretty quickly after she had signed on with the same agency that I'm using. And I just was really anxious to hear the story of how her meeting with her birth mother had gone.
And she said that she thinks at the beginning it's going to be very tough for her, although she wants me to be there when the baby's born. But so far, it's better than I had let myself hope it would be, you know.
Less than a week later, I got a call from Sheila Maloney, who's a private adoption attorney and a friend of my family's. I had asked Sheila to keep an eye out for a baby for me.
There's something brewing.
Something's brewing, I think she said.
And I need to talk to you to see if this is something you want to go with.
My name is Sheila Maloney. I help my clients run various ads in newspapers to attract birth mothers that might call in on an ad. Something similar to adoption would be the answer to our prayers. It's like a 60-word or less way to sell yourself.
Sheila had said, listen, you know, you should give me your birth mother letter, because sometimes I get these women who call, and they are, especially if you're open to any race baby, my clients are mostly white, and they want mostly white babies, and so I have to refer the women of color away to usually to an agency. So she said, I could just refer them to you.
I came across this ad in a paper. And I think her name was Sheila. And, started talking to her. But I didn't give, like, my name or nothing like that. I had gave another name just to see how it was and how it was going to play out.
She said, I have a friend who has a child that they cannot keep. And would this family be interested in adopting this baby? She told me a little bit about the situation with the child. The child was about 2 months old then. This is a full African-American situation. Suzanne has always been very open to that. So I sent her the profile of Suzanne. And when I talked to the birth mother about the fact that this was a single parent that I was going to send her, she said, that's fine. That does not matter to me.
I've been around a bunch of single women who had done it by themselves without a man's help. It too much didn't put, like, any doubt there. And race doesn't really matter to me because, like, people are people.
So I agreed to meet down in the south suburbs and got the address of a little pancake house. And so drove down and went to the pancake house, and a woman came striding across the parking lot. She introduced herself as the friend. And as we were going in, she had a couple kids in the car and said that her sister was going to be, came along to watch the kids, and she would take her baby inside. So we went inside to this place and sat down, and the baby was on the same side as me with on a little the bench part, and she sat on the seat opposite. And I said, now, what is your baby's name? And she said the name of the baby that was to be adopted. And I suddenly realized that this was the baby. And I looked at her, and she kind of smiled a little sheepishly, and she said, it's actually my baby that is being adopted. So here I was, looking at this baby that could possibly be my daughter. And it was like angels came out of the clouds and harps started playing. And you know how babies sometimes will, like, stare really intently at you, and it's probably because they have gas. But, you know, this baby was looking right in my eyes. That's what I felt. I just felt like we had a little moment together.
I saw the joy in Suzanne's eyes. Kind of gave me just a little bit hope that she was going to be a good mother and that she needed the opportunity.
And we proceeded to talk for about 2 hours, and this woman is just a delightful woman who already has three children, and she's 23, and she just knows that she can't handle this herself.
Going from place to place and knowing whether or not you was going to have a place to sleep, that was the major thing that was going on in my head. In my heart, I felt like I would be cheating her and couldn't give everything that I knew a baby should have.
I got into my car and just wept. I just cried and cried and cried. Tears of joy. You know, I held this baby and I realized that I think I've met my daughter. I think I just met my daughter. Since that first meeting with the birth mother, things have been moving really fast. We've spoken on the phone a number of times, and she's having several counseling sessions with the social worker, which is required by law. So I could end up getting this baby in a matter of a couple of weeks. But I'm reminded tonight at my last transracial adoption workshop that the rug can be pulled right out from underneath you.
I'm Ann. Last month when I was here, I had been picked by a birth mom, and I had a fall through after the baby was born.
The mother went into labor really early, and so Anne dropped everything, you know, raced down to this small town in Illinois, was there for the birth, literally held the mother's hand through the whole birth experience.
And the baby, who I spent like 5 days in the hospital with, in the nursery with, which was just awesome, got placed with the birth mom's father, who had wanted the baby all along, had not been supportive of the adoption. And I feel very conflicted about even having this conversation with you, because the last thing I want to do is, like, take away from what should be really, like, an exciting, fun time.
Right. And it did take the wind out of my sails a little bit. I mean, I did kind of take a step back and go, whoa, this could happen, and I need to sort of keep this in the back of my head.
So, well, good luck.
Thanks.
And stay in touch.
Okay.
I feel hopeful and excited for you.
Thanks. There are a couple of things that worry me about my situation. The birth mother's mom doesn't know her daughter's plans for the baby, and they all live together.
We don't have such a great open relationship to the point to where I would actually talk to her, you know, because she's already going through stuff herself. She's not that parent that you can say, do you understand what I'm going through?
This really concerns me because there's the specter in my mind that the mother will figure it out and try to talk her out of it. The other thing that's really keeping me up nights is that the birth mother hasn't been able to get me the medical records for the baby yet. The birth mother has actually already signed temporary custody papers, which means I could essentially take the baby at any time, which she actually seems really anxious for me to do. It's really tempting, but my gut says to wait until I get the medical records to make sure the baby doesn't have any physical or developmental problems. This is something that is profoundly personal for me.
I'm Mary, Suzanne's mother. With two of my children, there were problems at the time of birth which resulted in handicaps, one severe handicap. And I know what that can mean to a family and to a mother. Suzanne just took on chores that a child her age wouldn't normally take on. She looked after the next one in line and worried about the other children.
And I just feel like I've kind of paid my, like, universal karmic dues in that regard. And it's just, it's a lot of extra time and energy and money that, especially right now as a single person, I don't think I have and I don't think I am equipped for. I'm painfully aware that this adoption could fall through, but there's also a really good chance that I could have a baby in a couple of weeks. When I think about the fact that most women have about 9 months to feather their nest, I decide I better get cracking.
Good evening, Target guest. Can I guess of a black Nissan Sentra?
Well, we're here at Target, my mom and I, because we are going to look at some baby things. You want to go over here first, or what do you want to look at first? This is kind of the crash course in baby preparation.
A car seat, crib, a gate.
First of all, you know, I had to share all my decisions and opinions with my mother, who I love, but, you know, she's my mother. And maybe a changing table.
Ah, you don't need that.
Oh, boy, here we go. This will be fun.
First of all, it takes up space, and I got through all you kids without one of those things. You just change them on the bed.
Yeah, but then you got to bend over and hurt your back.
If your back's that weak, I don't know if you should have this baby.
Mom, whose baby is it?
Well, I don't... Okay.
Mom, you're just going to have a lot of opinions. I can tell already.
You don't want my opinion. Is that right?
You can give me an opinion, but don't give me it as if it's fact.
If it were me.
Can I ask you where something is?
Sure.
The snugglies, you know, that you carry the baby on your front?
My favorite purchase was the purchase of a little baby carrier sling that you carry on yourself. It was kind of funny because my mother zeroed in on one right from the start. She said, this one looks like the best one. It looks soft, and I think maybe just to defy her, I had to go through all the other ones first.
This is nice. It's pretty simple, right?
Yeah, it's just nylon-y stuff.
Mom, I think they're all nylon.
I don't think this one is.
And then it turned out she was right.
Easier to clean.
Imagine that. My mother was right.
Mom, I hate to say it, but you were right.
Oh, I know it hurts, doesn't it?
And that also feels really practical and personal. Like, I'm going to be taking that with me to go get that baby.
I could picture a baby in there, but I don't, you know, it's the kind of thing that I don't want to do because things could happen.
There's still a chance that this might not happen. But when I got to the store, I got started seeing all the stuff. Something clicked in about, you know, that this is really happening, and I got really excited. And I think my mother is still very concerned about protecting me and protecting herself.
You know, just for fun now, Mom, can we just have the joy of this? Because there will be a baby. So you're kind of killing the joy by kind of keep reminding me that it might not happen.
Well, I guess I'm trying to...
Just don't... I understand what you're doing, and I understand you, and I know you well. But for me, it's more fun to be excited about this.
Well, I'm excited. There's no question about that.
There will be a child. So we're buying this for my baby. Okay, just go with that. Work with that.
Well, for the past, I'd say almost week, we've been waiting for the birth mom to provide medical records on the baby and anything that she had on herself about her prenatal care. And I just found out just yesterday that she had all the records and she read them over the phone to me, and all the correct tests were negative for both herself and the baby, and that was a big relief. So I'm on my way. I'm on my way to go pick up my daughter. I have my mom and I, and we're taking my mom's car because I'm not sure why we're taking my mom's car.
I wouldn't let my granddaughter ride in a car like yours.
Thanks a lot.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
We're actually going to have five. We're meeting five? One more person, yeah.
We're at the Olive Garden, and we're in the suburbs, and the pickings were slim. They called churches to see if any churches were open in the evening in the area, and none were. And she didn't want to do it at her house, of course, because her family was there. So where do you do something like this, you know?
And it was either an Applebee's or an Olive Garden. And I opted for the exotic Olive Garden. So that's where we are.
Maybe she'll always love Italian music because of that.
And I'm just waiting for the birth mom to show up. She called ahead and said that she was running a little bit late.
And we waited and waited. And I couldn't say anything to Suzanne, but my mind was saying, she's not going to come. She's not going to come.
So I waited in the vestibule, which was the longest 15 minutes I've waited in a while. And then she called me.
Hello.
She actually called from the parking lot, said she was there.
Oh, good.
So I went out and met her, and she was with her sister. And she had the baby, of course. And went out and gave her a hug.
How are you?
How you doing?
She seemed like what I had come to know, which is a very sort of poised and relaxed and gentle, easygoing woman. She didn't seem nervous to me, but she's kind of got this sort of imperturbable way about her. I think it's protection, you know. I think it's just how she copes.
I was nervous, though, really, really tense, really nervous. But it wasn't like a bad type of emotion. It was more like, you know, like a happy one, like I knew she was in the right place.
All right, how's everybody? Good. My name is Christy. I'm going to be your server. Hi there.
Hi.
We sat down at the table, and the baby was facing the birth mom, so I couldn't really see the baby.
She was almost like a no man's zone. She didn't belong, really, to either mother.
So we're eating, and her phone rang. And she answered, and it was her mother asking her if she could take her to work because her car had broken down.
Was your man and me about to have to leave?
You have to leave?
Yeah.
See, really?
I have to go drop my mom off at work.
Oh. So now we were sort of forced to address what we were all there for, which was to give this baby to me.
Are you okay about this?
Oh, yeah.
I'm fascinated by somebody who has been, you know, pretty unemotional about it. Even on the moment that she handed the baby to me.
You want to give her a little kiss?
Yeah, sure.
I think she kissed her and whispered something. I kind of looked away. I wanted it to be a private moment for her in a very public place. But by then, the whole restaurant was, I think, aware of what was happening.
I guess, you know, at that point, I had more feelings for the mother and what she was leaving behind than I did for Suzanne and what she was being given.
My heart was pounding. Everything was just magnified in that moment because I just knew what was happening.
Well, I'll talk to you later, okay?
Yeah, I'll be in. We'll talk to you this week.
Okay.
And in her kind of typical matter-of-fact way, you know, gathered her things together, and I gave her a one last hug.
And then they got up and walked out, left the baby there, and never turned around. And I just thought, oh, what a brave thing to do, to love a baby enough to turn it over to someone who could care for it better.
And there I was with my baby.
That's unbelievable. I just can't believe it.
Or I should say the baby at the time. I don't think it felt like my baby, you know.
Oh.
And I said, Mom, do you want to hold her? It was the first time my mom had gotten to see the baby.
I hadn't thought about what the baby would look like because that was so secondary to the baby itself. But then I saw this baby with these enormous eyes and this beautiful little mouth. And I think I worried more than ever that this mother could never give up this baby. I think I waited a long time for that mother to turn around and come back in and say she had changed her mind.
And then a man came from across the way, a big African-American guy came over and extended his hand and said, congratulations, God bless you, congratulations. I wish you the best of luck.
God bless you. You and my prayers.
Thank you so much.
It just seemed like sort of a little visit from a little angel or something, you know, just giving me the blessings. I've just pictured myself walking into the house with her, you know, saying this is our house.
Here's your house.
This is where we're going to live. They're waiting for you.
Suzanne knew she wanted to be a mother. But when she turned 40, she was still...
You know, I was going to make an MP3 file out of this and send it separately, but I decided you needed to hear this. No matter how gut-wrenching and how nauseous it makes you. These are women that are poised against their own race. Did you hear in the beginning? She couldn't possibly find a guy to have a baby with. With millions of white men in this country, you couldn't find a partner? Well, that's a lie. You know that. She's delusional, or maybe she's homosexual. I don't know. But there's something weird about this family. Of course, the black mother, she's thrilled to get rid of the little bastard. She's already got two. And so, you know, you don't hear as much of this around on the radio or especially the right wing. You need to hear it. You need it to grab you in the gut and twist your guts. And the men out there, white men, you see what's happening? They're stealing your women by the thousands, the tens of thousands. When I say your women, I don't mean it in a condescending way. I just want you to remember that. I mean, if you're worried about the race being destroyed, or at least the working class part of a white race, well, this is where it starts. It's been going on now for decades and decades. And it's one easy way they've got to get rid of you. Now, the elitist and the ruling class, they might allow a little bit of it, but not very much. Because that's not in the predatory capitalist plan. This is in the predatory capitalist plan. Because if they didn't want this to happen on a large scale, it wouldn't be happening, believe me. You notice that all of a sudden there's things catch on, like homosexuality, which was never a great big problem. And now it's going crazy. And all of a sudden everything, transgender stuff, all of a sudden appears in every country almost in the world, especially every Western country. Now, do you think that's an accident? I don't. I can see it happening here and there, but not to the fast rate it's happening. So they're moving, and so when they have problems, Tommy says, good, good. As far as sociology is concerned, we must either abandon our reason or abandon Christ. He is preeminently the prophet of unreason, the preacher of rabble rabies, all that is enervating and destructive of manhood he glorifies, all that is self-reliant and heroic he denounces. Lazarus, the filthy and diseased vagrant, is his hero of heroes, and Dives the insane, energetic citizen, and his awful example of baseness and criminality. He praises the humble and he curses the proud. He blesses the failures and the damns and the successful. All that is noble he perverts. All that is atrocious he upholds. He inverts all natural instincts of mankind and urges us to live artificial lives. He commands the demonization of virtues and aggrandizes a people and advises his admirers to submit in quietness to every insult, contumely, indignity, to be slaves, de facto. Indeed, there is scarce one thought in the whole of his dicta that is practically true. 14:5. See you tomorrow, Tuesday.